This past week, as threats flew back and forth between our country and North Korea, and the specter of nuclear holocaust showed its ugly face again, it was interesting to look back to the year I was born, 1962, and the missile crisis, which had everyone on edge back then. For the first 30 years of my life, the little I learned in school about that crisis was just about all that I knew of Cuba. Well, maybe besides Ricky Ricardo and those cigars I wasn't allowed to buy for my dad when I went to Europe. Cuba, close enough for Diana Nyad to swim to the U.S. from its shores, close enough for Leon Gonzalez and his mother to attempt to escape to the U.S. in a small aluminum boat and end up as a huge controversy in already strained U.S.-Cuban relations as Cuban Americans fought to keep the young boy, whose mother died in the crossing, in the United States even as his father remained in Cuba. I, like many others here in the United States, know very little about the country, which lies less than 100 miles away from our shores. Batista, Castro, Guantanamo Bay, the Bay of Pigs, that was certainly the extent of my knowledge of Cuba until 1989. In 1989, I was invited to join Grupo Manos, an Afro-Cuban band here in Kansas City. It was there that I met two men from Cuba, Pablo La Rosa, a guest on tonight's show, and Agustin Romero Diaz. Agustin was one of many Cubans who came to the USA in 1980 as part of the Mario boatlift. During an economic downturn, Castro allowed these Cubans to come to the United States, and by the time the U.S. stopped accepting these economic and political refugees, 125,000 Cubans had made their way to the shores of Florida. Agustin was a master of Afro-Cuban music, the music which owed part of its origins to the African slaves brought over by Spanish conquistadors. The religion of the Yoruba tribe is evident in Afro-Cuban music, along with forms with more Latin American flavors such as the rumba. Agustin was a master drummer and singer and taught many people in the Kansas City area about Afro-Cuban music. For decades, he held court in Luce Park, leading a drum circle and teaching anyone who had a desire to learn about his music and his culture. I sang with Agustin even though my Spanish was very poor. One of his favorite tricks was to teach me words which I probably wouldn't have sung had I known what they meant. This was his honorary side. However, he was also thrilled to teach us his religious music and songs that he had sung as a boy. I remember Agustin and Pablo singing a song which went, "Si, si, si, yo soy habanero." Yes, 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 I'm from Havana. Agustin, you see, was homesick. He and Pablo would speak with great longing about going back to Cuba when Castro was gone. It's a hard thing to be a refugee. Agustin was never at home here. His heart was back in Cuba, and he clinged to that which still connected him to his homeland, his music. I really learned about Cuba from Agustin. I learned about those people who populate a so-called enemy country. I learned about those undesirable refugees we want to send in a boat back to where they came from because we consider our own lifeboat to be overflowing. I learned a bit about what it feels like to be a stranger in a strange land, where everything, the language, the food, the religion, and the music is foreign to you. To be a refugee is never to feel at home again. I learned so much from Agustin as I have from many people who have come to our shores from distant or not so distant lands and found that they would never have an opportunity to return. In the Obama administration, the relations between the two countries opened up embassies, and it looked as though Cuba and the United States were entering a new era. However, President Trump has recently announced plans to cancel some of Obama's Cuba policy. The future of our relationship with Cuba remains uncertain. At any rate, Agustin Romero Diaz will not be returning to Cuba. He died in 2014 at the age of 67, having never had a chance to return. The show is dedicated to his memory. This is Julie Bennett Hume, co-host and producer of River City Chautauqua. Pablo La Rosa was born in Cuba in 1944 and grew up in Varadero. In 1959, he came to the U.S. at the invitation of an American family in Cincinnati, Ohio, where he spent a school year learning English. After living for a year and a half in Miami, he moved to Colorado, where he studied at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley. He then attended the University of Kansas on a graduate fellowship to study Latin American and Spanish literatures. He taught at Graceland College, Kansas State University, and Baker University, retiring in 2009 from full-time teaching. Pablo is the author of Forbidden Fruit and Other Stories, published by the University of Houston Arte Público Press. He was the recipient of a Centis Fellowship for writing and was a finalist in the Letras de Oro Literary Competition, sponsored by the University of Miami. He has lived in the Kansas City area since 1978. Tonight, we will hear several short works by Pablo. We will also hear Cuban music from Pablo and Gary Helm. Gary is a 45-year veteran of the Kansas City music scene. He specializes in the music of Cuba, Brazil, and the West Indies. For the past 10 years, Gary's been a member of the Traditional Music Society, a group of musicians dedicated to educating the public in the techniques of Cuban and Brazilian percussion and hand drumming. The Traditional Music Society performs and holds workshops in Kansas City schools year-round. Gary is a former member of the Grammy-nominated Blue Rhythm Band and has recorded with many of Kansas City's brightest talents.
My name is Akis Kalaitzidis, and I have been doing a college study tour to Havana, Cuba for the last 2 years. And I'm here to talk about this, my experiences, why Cuba. I'm originally from Greece, and therefore people ask me, why not Greece, for example? Why not Europe? Cuba interests me personally in terms of politics, and because I'm a political science professor, it's a fascinating place to go. And the students hear a lot about what is happening in the politics these days, the opening of Cuba, now the closing of Cuba. We'll see how the future will go with this administration. So everybody's interested and wants to know, but there is a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions of what the country is like. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the expectations I had and what I found when I went there, and the differences between the 2 years. And the three things that attracted me to Cuba, of course, is history and politics, and its culture. And it was a hard place to get to go because it needed a lot of paperwork and it needed a lot of organization. It's not a normal destination for Americans. So that also added to the excitement. Now, in terms of history, the place has got America written all over it. You cannot leave the place without not thinking about the impact the United States had on that country and vice versa. The face of Ernest Hemingway, one of the greatest writers of the United States, is everywhere. Of course, he's very famous. His house is a museum there, and it's a fantastic place to visit. The stories of him playing with the kids, and there is an actual baseball field on his house, where a little kids' baseball team plays, because he loved kids, and he was famous for being a funny guy and playing around with them. And then of course there's the historical areas of Havana and the big hotels that were built by the mafia, the United States during the Batista regime, which is also a very attractive feature of the country. You know, Mayor Lansky, Lucky Luciano, they were all down there. Similar to what you see in Godfather 2, which is kind of a, you know, it's still there. It looks like that. It's like being in that movie 30 years ago. Also got a very difficult relationship with the United States in terms of politics. And that was a part of our going there to learn, at least to see how a different political system works. And of course, having seen it, I can't say it works. Fidel Castro himself said it doesn't, we need to change it. And in the 2 years that I have been going back and forth, and my colleagues have been, because we have a different program as well, that right now is in Cuba doing volunteer work, we've noticed a lot of the changes going on. There's a lot more private entities, a lot more stores to buy things. Within a year, the center of Havana has changed in terms of activity. So the country is constantly changing. And it's fascinating to see it happening. Now, they put a premium in terms of equality. We put a premium in terms of competition. And that puts the two countries in a totally different cultural space, I think, where they have different priorities. And Cubans will tell you this when you start talking. And one of the things that we had the first year that we were there, it was like, be careful how you talk politics with the people. You don't want to get anybody in trouble. You don't want to get yourself in trouble either. But as soon as we got there, we found out that people will tell you their opinion if they have it, and they're not, the government presence isn't that huge. It's just that, of course, you cannot undermine it. And there is in the second year, there's significant more activity you can see in terms of dissent, which I noticed the second year we went that I hadn't noticed the first year. There is the Orwellian 2+2=5 everywhere. Young kids who want to change the government post this around. But when you talk about the regime itself to the people, and the people who probably are more willing to talk to you about politics, if you made friends, it was very easy to make friends in Cuba. They will tell you, as a political scientist, I get the sense that the regime is still legitimate, even though it hasn't produced all that it was supposed to. The people do think that the regime itself made an effort to help out, and they tell you on the streets, even those who you would be hanging out on and you have a fairly, secure way of believing them, that they're talking, that they're telling you the truth about what their life is. They believe that the regime did a good faith effort to develop the country. Their healthcare is very good. There is a doctor for every 50 people that visits everyone in their home, for every building. There are smaller clinics all over Havana and bigger hospitals on the outskirts. They make their own vaccines. They train their doctors, and of course, unfortunately, they also use them as trade with Brazil and Venezuela for oil and things and money. But the fact of the matter is that people do notice the change between the Batista years and the Castro years. Universal education is another one. Every kid goes to school and every kid gets fed, which is, for a country of 11 million that has a GDP which is very low, it's not easy to pull off. There isn't that much heavy industry in Cuba. They rely on the stuff that they produce, like sugarcane, coffee, cigars, rum, and that is not always being, you know, primary products. It's not always easy to trade for things that have high value added. You know, you need a lot of sugar to buy a plane. So people I found in general are friendly to the regime. They don't want to see it go away the way the Soviet regime went. And the government actually, it seems to me, that from talking to different colleagues and people in Cuba, that is actually thinking of going towards the Chinese model as opposed to the Soviet model, which is we're going to scrap it and start from the beginning. They do a gradualist change, and I think that's better for the Cuban people as well. Now, of course, the fascinating part of being in Cuba is also walking around and talking to people and actually witnessing the fact that they don't care to tell you about what they think about their government, which is one of the biggest misconceptions that Americans have, that there is a police state. Yes, there is police around, no more than any other place I've been, and I've been to many countries around the world. So it was interesting to get in a taxi and tell the taxi driver, we like Cuba, and he'd say, yeah, we need to develop, and you say, but you have a great education and a great healthcare system. And you say, I'd rather pay and get a private doctor rather than, stay in line and do it. That's a very negative statement against the government. But they don't, they didn't seem like they feared the government. Well, the relationship with the United States can always be, of course, kind of difficult. That discussion is always I always advise my students to be a little more careful. The United States' role in Cuba has not exactly been constructive. From the blockade, which, of course, you walk around Havana and you see all these big posters, end the blockade is genocide, blah, blah, blah. That's the propaganda posters that the government puts up. But, the majority of the world thinks of Cuba as being mistreated by the United States. And knowing the history of, certain acts of terrorism that have taken place in Cuba by American-supported groups, things that we have done to prevent them from developing or achieving their goals, it's kind of sometimes a difficult subject. Generally speaking, the Cubans are very open about, like, saying we need to be friends rather than we need to be enemies. And that's kind of key. You walk around the streets, you see the younger people wearing a lot of American flags on them. Partly some of the kids are, of course, telling the government that it's time to change. Partly it's just American culture, being transferred to a place that is just across the street. It is interesting, though, to see it, and it's interesting to see that the government doesn't fear it, that it moves on with its plans. Now, if you talk to a Cuban about the role of the United States, they always be a little bit uncomfortable telling you that we have been behaving like bullies to them. But, the evidence is everywhere. You go to the museum where the grandmother, the boat by which Raul and Fidel and Che Guevara and all these guys came from Mexico to Cuba in 1959 to start the revolution is there, and then there so are the pieces of the U-2 spy planes, and you know there are missiles and all you go down to the south where the Bay of Pigs is, and they have the catamarans, which they were the invasion force in the Bay of Pigs. It's you're not gonna get too many friendly responses, but I think the Cubans already are past it in terms of that they. Fidel himself, I was told by the ambassador of the United States now to Havana, that Fidel himself thought that by the time Carter came around, it would have the relationship would have normalized and the embargo would have been lifted. Unfortunately, of course, there was a big fallout with the Soviet Union during the Carter administration. And human rights and, you know, the Zakharov case and all that stuff. So Cuba didn't get to see the embargo lifted until the Obama administration, which is, of course, again, he didn't lift the embargo because only the U.S. Congress can do that. But he effectively ended major parts of it and allowed people to go like, you know, school students, you know, university students to go study in Cuba and find out what the differences and what the logic behind that government was. And it's now walking backwards. So I think the Cubans, last time we left there, we hugged our guide who took us to the Escambray Mountains, fantastic place, beautiful walking around in nature. And we hugged our guide and he said, please pray for my country. You know, the expectation was that with the new administration, there will be a lot of punishment coming for Cuba. So far, there hasn't been a lot, a little bit of a restriction to travel to Cuba, but not that much. I believe there is a growing segment of, I'm by no means an expert on this, but what I read is there's a growing segment of Cubans in the United States who think that the Obama approach was better, especially the youngsters who are away from the old time, you know, mafia revolution, assassination type of thing in the 60s, and they want to go back to their grandparents, they want to see their family, they don't want to be restricted, they don't understand why we're doing this, and it seems to me that Senator Marco Rubio is working on sort of moderating some of this, and I think that's a good idea because, you know, the Cold War is over. And although I love studying it, I love going to Cuba and meeting people in Cuba, it's a thing of the past. And you know, we're friends with China. I mean, why can't we be with Cuba? And that's kind of the thing that you're going to get in Havana as well. And the last thing I wanted to say was one of the things that attracts you to Cuba is its culture. I mean, from the historical forts of the Spanish, you know, the Spanish fortifications to the present day cigar making, the island has everything. It's very warm, welcoming people. They embrace you and they want to show you around. It's, you know, beautiful music. You can't get away, a block away from where you're staying without meeting beautiful musicians who play absolutely wonderful music. You know, talk to people on the side, they'll tell you their life, and they will ask you, they want to know about you. It's a very friendly country and has zero crime, which was... It's a lot different than most of the countries that I've been in. There is absolutely no reason for you to worry about walking around in places that would look like, well, in places that have been actually in movies like in the United States that look shady and stuff. No crime, no problems as such. So it's a very safe place to go, and I always feel welcome.
John Simmons is chair and professor of philosophy at the University of Kansas. He is the author of numerous books and articles in philosophy of mind, epistemology, philosophy of science, and metaphysics. His most recent book is Formal Reasoning, A Guide to Critical Thinking. He has taught philosophy around the world, including at Peking University in Beijing, at the University of Lisbon, and at the Federal University of Bahia in Salvador, Brazil. His current interests include working to understand the effects of technological and social changes on the quality and significance of human lives.
In 2012, an unusually hard winter and a powerful snowstorm made it difficult for trucks to deliver goods to the Romanian city of Iași. After 2 weeks of bad weather, gaps were appearing on the grocery store shelves, and fruits and vegetables were becoming scarce. One of my relatives tells the story of how, as he stepped in from the cold, he stood in shock at the sight of the empty shelves. Another man of about the same age understood precisely why Liviu reacted as he did. Both men remembered the decades before the revolution of 1989, when empty shelves were caused by human ignorance and hubris rather than snowstorms. They recalled the years when the dictator Nicolae Ceausescu imposed brutal repression and economic stupidity on the people of Romania. Ceausescu was an opportunistic and vicious egomaniac at the head of a communist regime that tried, with varying degrees of success, to reach into the most intimate aspects of the lives of its subjects. Abortion was criminalized, families were separated, religious expression was discouraged, food was scarce, gatherings of more than a few people were prohibited, books and music were subject to censorship. Expressing dissenting opinions could result in severe punishment, including imprisonment, torture, and death. Ceausescu was a particularly evil and petty man who was responsible for terrible harms to the people of Romania. Lives were ruined and talent was wasted. Empty shelves in the grocery store were certainly not the worst harms of his incompetent and malevolent dictatorship, but they are worth thinking about as we consider the proper role of government and markets in our lives. We should take seriously the remarkable fact that grocery stores in today's Romania are filled with the same kind of abundance we see in France, Germany, or America. The empty shelves that Liviu remembered were not unique to Ceausescu's regime. The common feature of communist societies in the 20th century was their failure to successfully provide for the material well-being of their people. As communist societies matured, they often struggled to meet even the most basic needs. Famines that took millions of lives were a reality in the history of the Soviet Union in the 1930s and 40s, and in China in the late 50s and 60s also. The communists failed economically, in spite of fertile land, talented, well-educated people, and an abundance of natural resources across their territories. With the pragmatic influence of Deng Xiaoping, the Communist Party in China began to slowly release their control over the economy in 1978. While the party continues to maintain political power by repressive means, they have allowed the creativity and intelligence of their people to express itself in economic activity. And China has seen hundreds of millions of people lift themselves out of poverty over the past four decades. And in some sense, the Communist Party deserves credit for this important development. But in the same way that you might thank your enemy for taking his booted foot from your throat. The economic policies of earlier communist regimes are preserved in Cuba and North Korea. Now, sadly, the Venezuelan government is squandering the resources and talents of its people as it follows Cuba into penury and repression. In countries where governments do not attempt to control prices and production to the extent that communist states attempted in the 20th century, we have seen extraordinary material progress. Contemporary Romania is not perfect, but the shelves are full, and life is significantly better for most people on almost every dimension. The simple but incomplete lesson of the 20th century is that governments should step aside and allow markets to develop freely in most domains. But We recognize at the same time that we want our governments to impose our values on society. We do not want to live in a country where people die from disease because they are unable to afford medical care, nor do we want children to go without education simply because they come from poor families. Most of us hope for dignified lives for ourselves and for others, where we are not forced into debasement and disease because of poverty. One of the goals of a decent society is that people are not made less than people because they are losers in the game of the marketplace. Economic life, of course, is not a zero-sum game, and today's poor in developed economies are materially wealthier by any measure than the poor of the past. Nevertheless, economic life has winners and losers. The socialist impulse focuses on maintaining the dignity of the losers, recognizing that many non-moral factors can lead people to lose. The reason that you are a loser in the marketplace is probably not because you are a bad person, nor does the fact that you are a winner in the marketplace necessarily make you a good person. The central insight in socialist ideology is that human dignity should not depend on where one ends up in the economic hierarchy. Poverty is not an indication of vice, and wealth is not an indication of virtue. At its best, the socialist insight distinguishes between the economic and moral value of the person. This includes protecting some very important areas of life from market forces. We recognize that some things, like friendship, for example, are not for sale. The error of socialism, when it comes to its relationship to the market, is thinking that we can shape markets according to moral values without doing harms in other ways. This is where knowledge comes in. By imposing controls on markets, the assumption is that we know more than we actually do. In the most extreme case, the communist dictator's hubris, as with Ceausescu, involves thinking that he knows best. Specifically, the dictator mistakenly believes that he knows better than the market what the value of goods and services should be. The market pricing system is what philosophers call an emergent phenomenon. Given the complex interaction and cooperation of millions of people, the dictator cannot know how we collectively value a gallon of milk or a roll of duct tape. Each of us has different preferences that vary over time and interact with the preferences of others. When people are free to interact and pursue their economic interests independently, the market price emerges for goods and services. What's extraordinary about the price system is that it tells us things that we could not discover by ourselves. The market, in fact, is the best way, in many domains, for us to discover what the most efficient use of our time and energy should be. But the limit of the market pricing system is visible when we're put in a position where our very existence as participants in the market system is at stake. What is the value, the market value, of a human life? How much should we spend to prevent a death? Some people have to make decisions like this, and they do so with incomplete information. The Environmental Protection Agency, for example, prices a life at $9 million. The Food and Drug Administration prices a human life at about $8 million, and the Department of Transportation at $6 million. Since there's no market in human life, we have no real idea what the right number, if there is a right number, should be. From the perspective of the person himself, the question makes no sense, since his very participation in markets is in question. How can you price the very possibility of pricing? In sum, we've learned from the failure of communism that attempting to control markets is a disastrous error. The central moral failure of American ideology, by contrast, involves overextending market values into the realms of morality and meaning. We Americans have trouble recognizing that not everything is for sale, and the value of our own lives cannot be measured in economic terms.
Dracula's revenge. No, it is not my fangs, but my dreams. You need fear. My humid, lurid, lucid dreams, wild and surreal, like blind winged mammals probing the twilight by sonar. Long ago I learned dreams don't fare well in sunlight. Your stones and arrows, shoot them down in Penn or Transylvania. So for now, I keep them folded upon the walls of my caved mind while I endure corporate existence. But when sleep seals your caskets and not a rat race mouse stirs, their wings blossom like flowers from a black garden of evil. And I unleash my little vamps to roam the suburban skies. At my command, they break and enter your master bedrooms, pick the locks of your closed minds, implant my lucid visions inside your deadened brains, and leave a trail of guano on your shipwrecked waterbeds. The tooth fairy wears dentures, so losing a tooth is no big deal. A chunk of calcium, gone dead, detached from living tissue, gone rotten. Fill the hole with a plastic replica. No one will know the difference. I have filled so many holes with false hopes. An exposure of my soul would reveal advanced osteoporosis. Fortunately, not many have Clark Kent's vision, and he too was a fairy fraud.
Sugar from sugarcane originated in India. We get our English word sugar from the Sanskrit word shakara and the Arabic version sukar. The myth goes that sugar was invented for a prince who was in a temporary heaven because he wanted to go to paradise during his lifetime but was not allowed. After reconciliation between the prince and the king of heaven, the temporary heaven was destroyed, scattering sugarcane over the world of the mortals as a reminder. Gold is perhaps the only other substance to have greater impact on humanity than sugar. There is a long history of people and sugar, beginning with extracting the juice from the cane thousands of years ago in India. Then in Asia, people created granules from the juice. Sugarcane then spread around the Islamic world in the Middle Ages before transportation to the West Indies by Europeans. Christopher Columbus brought sugarcane on his second voyage to Hispaniola in 1493. Sugar spread to the rest of the Caribbean and South America from there. Sugar did not come to Cuba as quickly as other Caribbean islands until the 19th century, brought primarily by refugees from the Haitian Revolution next door. Cuba soon became the most important sugar producer in the world by the 1880s, until replaced by Brazil. The sugar trade was linked to slavery. Slaves were often worked to death on sugar plantations. Slavery and the sugar trade became indissoluble. Eventually, abolitionists held sugar boycotts and inflicted economic pressures on the sugar industry. These and other pressures were part of the end of formal slavery, which in turn brought new industrial developments to the sugar industry. But slavery continued illegally, and even today, slavery-like conditions exist in the sugar industry in the Caribbean. Sugar was a chief component in the transatlantic triangle, and Cuba is located prominently on the trade routes of that triangle between Africa, the Americas, and Europe. The transatlantic triangle worked like this. Slaves were taken from Africa and sent to the New World to work on sugar plantations. The sugar was then sold in Europe for goods to be taken to Africa and traded for slaves, and the cycle started over. This lasted for 3 centuries. Human trafficking, commodities trading, and the multicultural interaction that accompanied it. Europeans always dominated and controlled the African culture in the Americas. Much of the musical traditions of Cuba trace back to this interaction. Slaves sang songs about sugar. African religious ceremonies combined with those imposed by Europeans. Out of the horror of slavery came new rhythms and musical expressions. Of course, this cannot validate slavery in any way, but it does show the resilience and eternal manifestation of the human spirit. I'm Scott Easterday for River City Chautauqua.
Sergeant Sugar. In Cuba, you were born with your basic reflexes, plus one that was just as critical for survival, fear of the police. Whether the uniform was the foreboding blue of the city cop or the cacophonous khaki of the regular army, your natural reaction was to freeze upon spotting one. As a child, I witnessed the beating of a drunkard right at our doorsteps. He had refused to go home when commanded. The policeman drew his nice stick and clubbed the man until the poor bastard fell unconscious to the ground. If my genes didn't carry fear of the uniform from centuries of Spanish oppression and decades of dictatorship, I assure you they mutated right then and there. To this day, after years of residence in the land of the free, I cannot help feeling guilty of some unspecified crime when I see a policeman. If I am driving, I slow down, even though I am not speeding. When I go into a bank or an expensive store, I am uncomfortably aware of the guard's scrutiny. I cannot overcome this phobia. It is as indelible as my accent. The chief of police in my hometown was a crude fellow who happened to be on the right side when Batista pulled his coup. As a reward for his loyalty, he was promoted to sergeant and given the job vacated by a man who supported the wrong politico in the power struggle. Since his name sounded like the Spanish word for sugar, he was dubbed Sergeant Sugar, a nickname that was doubly appropriate because he suffered from diabetes. Sergeant Sugar was fond of riding in the back seat of his patrol car, a sleek blue Oldsmobile from the new fleet Batista acquired for his henchmen. He rode slowly and systematically through town, instilling into every man, woman, and child the certainty that he was always looking over your shoulder. More than once, the beam of his searchlight had exposed a young couple on the beach. More than once, a warning blast from his siren had sent us scrambling after raiding Dr. Maribona's mango tree. Yes, he was omnipresent, omniscient, and like God, silent. When he had something to say to someone, he would stay in the car and let his bodyguard do the talking. A couple of years after Batista's coup, Fidel Castro landed in Oriente province with his ragtag rebels. Things got hot. Every day we heard rumors of attacks on army garrisons or police stations. Our town was small, isolated, and by and large peaceful. But Sergeant Sugar took no chances. He posted sentries at headquarters around the clock. His bodyguard began toting a machine gun in addition to his sidearm. One morning, after a terrorist bomb blew up a power relay station, two men were found hanged on a ceiba tree a few kilometers inland. The bodies were brought to the town square, dumped in the middle, and exhibited for the entire day. Each had a cardboard sign strung around its neck with the words, "Por Revolucionario," printed in deep red. The message was effective. In the 3 years of fighting, not another anti-government incident took place in our town. When people there discussed the revolution, they whispered. The name Castro was unspeakable. No one could prove it, but all believed Sergeant Sugar had executed the hangings. My father got me a surprise for my 13th birthday. He had gone to Havana on business, and I expected a new watch or perhaps even a bicycle. But I was really thrilled to find a gun on my bed when I got home from school. I had used Aldo's BB on occasion, but this particular kind was a pellet model that proved powerful enough to consistently shatter bottles from a distance of 30 feet. It ripped lizards in two as if they were made of papier-mâché. and gutted sparrows I shot for target practice as they groomed their feathers on the almond tree behind our house. I was really honing my aim and felt proud of its deadliness. One afternoon, I went over to an abandoned field that had quite a bit of unchecked growth. Some kids claimed they had seen a big snake in the brush, and I wanted to test my new weapon on larger game. I combed the place for a good half hour with no luck. I didn't want to go home empty-handed, so I decided to try to shoot one of those finches Columbus describes in his Diary of the Discovery of Cuba. Next to sparrows, these birds are diminutive and much more beautiful. Their chests are covered with a golden down, and their wings tips are yellow-green. They never stand still for more than a second, so to hit one with a single pellet is difficult. After stalking one for a good while under a tree, one finally landed. As I came back out of the field onto the dirt road, Sergeant Sugar was driving by. The Oldsmobile slowed, stopped, and the bodyguard motioned me over. The inborn fear of the uniform seized me. My legs refused to move, and my tongue froze. Realizing I wasn't going anywhere, Sergeant Sugar's driver put the car in reverse and pulled up to where I stood. All I was conscious of was the black machine gun on the front seat. "You shot that finch?" Sergeant Sugar asked. His voice sounded as I imagined it would, thunderous and oligarchical. I showed him where the pellet severed my trophy's neck. "Good shooting." "Thank you, sir," I stammered, feeling somewhat relieved. "Are you going to eat it?" "Oh, no, sir. I'm going to bury it after I show it to my friends." "Bury it? You mean you shoot birds for the hell of it?" I searched for an answer, any answer, but I was too confused. I gave up. "I guess so. You don't kill nothing. For the hell of it, son. Let me have that gun. When you find a good reason, you come tell me. Maybe if I like it, maybe." They drove off. I stood on the dirt road until the sun got so hot, my eyes watered. 3 days after Batista fled Cuba, the first rebels stormed into town in a captured jeep. They were quite a sight with their long hair, matted beards, and battered Springfields. First thing they wanted to know was where the chief of police might be hiding. The tip led them to the sacristy. After negotiating through the priest, Sergeant Sugar surrendered with the promise of fair play. The trial was so swift, it might as well not have held it. The mother of one of the hangmen pointed a finger at Sergeant Sugar. That was all the evidence needed to convict him as a war criminal. Though the execution was public, I didn't go, but I heard the description so many times, I remember it as if I had been present. They stripped him of his uniform. In plain white clothes, he seemed as vulnerable as any human being. His unshaven face enhanced the forlorn look in his dark eyes. His fleshy lips quivered as he was blindfolded. Two militiamen pushed him against the freshly whitewashed wall. The officer in charge asked the crowd once more if anyone objected to the execution. 20 feet away, the three weathered Springfields were raised. A loud report, as if fire from a single rifle, and the wall became a bright canvas painted with blood.
Concludes this month's River City Chautauqua. We would like to thank Dr. Akis Kalaitzidis from the University of Central Missouri, Dr. John Simmons from the University of Kansas, Pablo LaRosa, Gary Helm, and Scott Tischner. Tune in next month for our show on chaos. This is Julie Bennett-Hume for River City Chautauqua.